Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Registered representative, securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Investment advisor representative, Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Fujiyama Wealth Management and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Lee Cantor here with Junko Horvath, another episode of Junko's Health, Wealth, and Happiness Hour, and it's brought to you, as always, by Fujiyama Wealth Management. Welcome, Junko. How are you doing today?
Great.
Got quite a crowd here again. You're spotlighting women who are doing amazing things.
Yeah.
And today is no exception.
Wonderful. Yeah, three fabulous women I brought today.
That's great. Who do you got?
Okay. I have Karen Anovitz-Grinzer and the executive director of J-Screen at Emory University, and then Lynn Goldman, adoption and assisted reproduction technology attorney from Claiborne, Fox, Bradley Law Firm, and Robin Sangston, the VP and the Chief Compliance Privacy Officer at Cox Communications.
So who do you want to lead off with?
Okay, I start with Karen from J-Screen.
All right, Karen Greenside. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
So tell us about what is J-Screen and when was it established? How long have you been involved in? And how the J-Screen is helping other people?
So J-Screen is a program out of Emory University School of Medicine's Department of Human Genetics. And we launched in September of 2013. The goal of our program is to help, essentially to help people plan ahead for healthy families. And our program is mostly around Jewish genetic diseases, which are, genetic diseases are common in any population, but we do see a number of diseases that are more common in the Jewish community. And what we know is there are two ways that you can find out that you're at risk for having a child with a genetic disease. Either you can have that child and then you know you're at genetic risk, or you can plan ahead by having testing and find out what genes you carry and what your future children might be at risk for. And what the J-Screen program does is it gives people access to this information ahead of time, and it makes that access easy for people.
Yeah.
So that essentially what you do is you go online to our website, jscreen.org. You learn about testing, you register for a screening test, and you do the testing with the saliva kit from home, which you mail into a laboratory. And our genetic counselors out of Emory provide information to you about your results by phone or video conference. So we're a national program, and we're just improving access to genetic screening.
Interesting.
And this all happens through saliva?
It is through saliva. And that's what allows us to let people do screening from home.
And then when you're doing this screening, are you only testing for these genetic diseases, or is it like some of those things that you see on the internet where they tell you all your ancestors and things like that?
So we are testing for over 200 genetic diseases that are prevalent not only in the Jewish community, but in other ethnic groups. So we call it a pan-ethnic panel. It's applicable to everybody. We don't do ancestry testing, and we don't do personal health testing, which some of these other companies do. This is strictly around genetic risk to future children.
And then, but is there a reason that you don't do these other things? Because like, isn't the collecting of the saliva and getting the DNA, that's, you're almost there, right?
Right. But yes, but we're mission driven to just do genetic screening. Yes.
So you said that you established the J-Screen in 2013. So the other race, you have that in Emory for other divisions too, but you just particularly do for the Jewish disease screening?
So this program was started because of risks in the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. But again, the testing that we do is applicable to everybody.
I see.
And this is very important because if you think about a Jewish genetic disease, maybe people have heard of Tay-Sachs disease before, mm-hmm. and a lot of screening programs early on around that. But the truth is, you don't have to be a Jewish-Jewish couple in order to have a child with Tay-Sachs. You can be a couple where one's Jewish and the other is not. You can even be a couple with where neither person is Jewish, because even though some genes are more common in certain ethnic groups, they're also seen in other groups.
It's not exclusive.
So it is not exclusive. And we encourage everyone to get tested. And a key point is we're encouraging people to get tested before they get pregnant. What is the reason for that? With these genetic diseases, what happens is you have two healthy parents who happen to be carriers for the same disease gene, like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell or Tay-Sachs disease. Each one of their pregnancies is at 25% risk. If they know that risk ahead of time, if they can do genetic testing and know that ahead of time, there are things that they can do to help plan ahead for a healthy child. And one thing, which Lynn is also going to talk about in regard to what she does, a couple might elect to do in vitro fertilization, where the egg is fertilized outside of the body, and genetic testing can be done on those embryos so that we can see which ones have the disease, and then the healthy embryos can be used for pregnancy. Had we not known about genetic risk ahead of time, that planning wouldn't be possible. Mm-hmm. Donor egg and sperm, there are different ways around this genetic risk, and that's the key point of trying to get this information out there early.
But there's no way to kind of remove that Tay-Sachs gene from the DNA?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. But we can use technology to test to see if it's there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, but the typical young couple who got married, they are healthy, young, and they don't think about,
right.
You know, unless they have like parents had the Tay-Sachs or whatever, you know, there is no relative who had the Tay-Sachs. And usually they don't even think about testing. How do you advertise or how do you make people know to be educated?
Yes. So this is the tricky thing about these recessive genetic diseases, because everyone is a carrier for different genetic diseases. We just don't know what they are. And the only way to find out is either to have an affected child or to get this testing done. We spend a lot of time and a lot of dollars trying to get this out to people so that they know that this is important. 80% of the time that a child's born with one of these genetic diseases, that disease is not in their family. They would have never known had they not done testing. So we do a lot of community education in the Jewish community. We educate rabbis, we educate doctors. We do crazy things, like we find celebrities who can get out there and talk about this so that we can let people know that they need to access screening.
Now, what's the ramification if they don't do the testing and then they have the child? Like, is this that the child doesn't survive a few years, or is this a chronic disease?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. We test for a variety of different conditions. Some are lethal in infancy. So a child can get sick a little bit later on. Some can even present in adulthood. And that's the importance of what we do, because we not only do testing, but we provide genetic counseling to talk about those results so that a couple understands what they mean. Now, I also want to point out that we find many, many carriers through this testing, but only about 3% of the time do we find that a couple's in a situation where they actually have children at risk and may want to think about planning ahead.
If both parents are carriers, does that mean the child will have it for sure? Or they'll...
So these are, good question. These are recessive genetic diseases. And if you'll remember your Punnett square from ninth grade biology class, each time that couple has a baby, there's a 25% chance that the child will be affected. It's not 100%.
Mm-hmm. So two recessives don't mean they'll have it.
Right. Only if they both pass that gene along, which happens 1 in 4, 25% mm-hmm. of the time.
So now how'd you get into this work?
Yeah. So I'm a genetic counselor by background, and mm-hmm. I got interested in genetic counseling many, many years ago because I was interested in science and interested in helping people understand the science. And I've been working at Emory since 1986 in genetics, doing a number of different things. And I really became passionate about this particular program because I grew up in the Jewish community here in Atlanta. And I felt that this was a way of giving back to the community using my genetics knowledge and helping get that out to as many people as possible.
So now how has the field changed over the years?
Completely. Yeah, unbelievably. Because when I went to school, we could talk about recessive inheritance, but there wasn't any real technology. We could say, here's your risk. And a lot of times it was a decision about having kids or not, or finding out during a pregnancy. And wow, genetic testing, we're able to test for so much. And there's so many things that a couple can do now to plan.
So now, how do you feel about all these kind of saliva tests that are doing the ancestor stuff? Are you for that or against it?
So ancestry testing is interesting. I would be very careful about doing a genetic test through a lab where genetic counseling is not provided, or some of these personal health tests, which actually don't tell you very accurately about risk to your own health. For example, going out with a BRCA or breast cancer test without genetic counseling follow-up, or with it being limited to certain communities, I would always recommend doing testing that's grouped with genetic counseling.
So now what about as the field expands, the getting into making kind of custom drugs based on an individual's genetics?
Yeah, so that's exciting. That's pharmacogenetics. Right. And it is exciting because then you're not just taking a shot in the dark,
right,
but you're really trying to target that therapy.
So you see that as on the roadmap as the field expands?
Yes, absolutely. Not something that I do,
right?
But it's going to be a big help to people.
And is this something that young people should consider as a career, or do you need more people in genetics?
In genetic counseling?
Yeah,
absolutely. So when I was looking for a job many years ago, I was looking for them. Now people are seeking out genetic counselors, and there are not enough genetic counselors to go around because all this testing is out there. And because there's so much in so many different specialty areas, it's a great field to go into now.
So is it a double-edged sword in that more people are curious and want to do it, but the technology isn't as kind of accurate as people think maybe that it is?
For personal health testing, yes. So it sounds cool and interesting.
Right.
But again, you need to be careful how those results are interpreted.
Right. And so there's a need for people that know that stuff.
Yes.
And then how is Emory kind of in play in this? Are they leaders in this area?
Yeah. So the genetics department at Emory is nationally, internationally known. And there are about 18 or so genetic counselors at Emory in different specialty areas and a number of physician medical geneticists. And as a team, we both help families who have children or adults with genetic problems, and also this kind of reproductive genetics area as well.
Now, can you share a story maybe where an individual you know or somebody has been affected by this and the genetic testing has helped?
Sure.
You don't have to name their names, obviously.
No, but no. Just how I won't do that. Yeah. So, you know, just as an example, I'll tell you what got our program started. And
okay,
I think this is a really relevant story. So there was a couple in Atlanta who really inspired the J-Screen program. And I'll say their name because they've been very public about it. Randy and Caroline Gold, who had an unaffected child, a healthy child, and then had a child with a Jewish genetic disease that was screenable at the time through carrier screening that we're talking about, but was not on the testing panel that their doctor ordered.
So they got screened for something,
yes,
but not this specific thing.
But not for this specific thing, and they could have been. And had this child who is now around 10 years old and is severely impacted by this genetic disease, and then went on to really help try to spread the word that this more expanded screening is important and available. Mm-hmm. And again, the couple had no family history of this genetic problem.
So it looked like it came out of...
It looked like it came out of nowhere.
And then,
right, but it didn't.
Right. In actuality, it was always lingering there.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's an example of why that's why you do the panel that's so broad.
Right. Because we want to catch everything based on your own ethnic group and other ethnic groups as well.
Right. And then, so what do you need more of? You're just trying to get the word out and let more people know about this?
Right. I mean, we always need resources to help get the word out to as many communities around the country as possible and to keep the program going and to expand what we do into other genetic testing areas.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And then what if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the website?
The website is jscreen, so jscreen.org.
Uh-huh. And they can go there and they can get all the information.
Get information and register for screening kit if they're interested.
And then also that would be if organizations wanted to partner with you around the country, they can get information there as well?
Yes. And they can go to info@jscreen.org and we'll be in contact with them immediately.
Well, again,
is that free?
The test?
Yeah.
No. So there's a program fee to go through for genetic screening.
I see.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a minimal. Yeah.
Yes. We try to keep the cost down regardless of insurance coverage. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But some insurance does cover this?
Some insurance does. Some insurance doesn't. But we have a set fee and we handle the rest of it. So regardless of deductibles, co-pays, et cetera, the cost is the same for everybody.
Wonderful.
Good stuff.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Great. So now that leads to Lynn Goldman, adoption and assisted reproduction technology attorney. Yeah. From the Claiborne and Fox and Bradley Law Firm. So what is the adoption lawyer? What do you do exactly?
Right. So my role as an adoption
attorney. Get in there, Lynn, in front of the
mic. Okay, sorry. My role as an adoption attorney and an assisted reproduction technology attorney is really to help people build their family, either through adoption or assisted reproduction. And part of my role is to help assure parentage for parties that are looking to build their family through adoption and assisted reproduction. So where a lawyer comes in is either when a party wants to adopt or to use third-party reproduction. So egg donor, sperm donor, embryo donation, or surrogacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So now, how many people go through the adoption? Is it more and more popular?
It is more and more popular. I would tell you that more people now are using assisted reproduction, whether it be in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, or again, third-party reproduction, more so than adoption. Unfortunately, there are not as many children out there to adopt as there used to be.
So that's people, good though, right?
That in some ways, that is good. Exactly. And in some ways, it's not. But with new technologies, people sometimes want to use their own genetics or to carry a child on their own. And so are turning to more
technologies. That's kind of the process. It's like you try to have a child, then you have problems, then you try to do something that you control yourself with your spouse.
Correct. Well, some people decide either that they want to adopt because that's the avenue that they choose.
Right.
Or some people decide to turn to ART first, assisted reproduction technology first. And then if that doesn't work, then sometimes they'll choose either to adopt or to use third party reproduction.
And then at what point do they go, I better call a lawyer?
usually that comes in, when they're kind of considering their family building journey, either that a social worker's referred them to an attorney if they're going the adoption route, or a doctor, assisted reproduction technology doctor, it's called a reproductive endocrinologist, will refer them to us to draft the contracts and to get an order declaring parentage.
And then what's your role? So your role, the couple comes to you or the individual comes to you and says, okay, I want to go down these paths, or are you helping them choose which path? Like what's your role?
So sometimes they'll come in and meet with us and they've already decided which path that they want to go. Or sometimes they come in and they're like, I'm not sure which path to go. Can you tell me about all of that?
Like kind of the pros and cons.
The pros and cons, how it all works, the cost, the time. That's usually the question that most people want to know. How long is this going to take? And what does it cost? Those are the big questions.
So how long does it take?
For adoption?
Or go through each one of them.
Okay. For adoption, it depends on what type of adoption you're going to do, whether a person's going to adopt through the child welfare system, whether they're going to adopt privately with a private agency, or they're going to look for an adoption situation using their own resources. So it sort of depends on which avenue they're looking at. But usually I would say it would take anywhere from 8 months to 2 years.
Wow. And then what if the child's like in another country?
So there is international adoption. I would say there's much less international adoption than there used to be because of the Hague Convention. Also the age of the children in other countries that are being adopted, they are usually not infants. So a lot of people, if they're looking for an infant, want to adopt domestically.
So that is in play too, the age of the child?
The age of the child.
So most people want an infant like within at what age?
Yeah, most people that come to me are looking for an infant, usually under one.
And then do some people want like 10-year-old, 12-year-old?
They do. And if that's the case, then they can go through the child welfare system, which is a lot less expensive route to go than a private adoption. But most people that are looking to go through the child welfare system first become foster parents and then adopt the child that they are fostering.
Do you help in that area as well?
I do. I used to be a child welfare attorney for 17 years and then switched over to family building.
Now, can you talk about the foster program? Because sure. that there's a lot of need in that area, isn't there?
There is. There's a huge need for foster parents. Right now, we're in Georgia, we are in an all-time high of kids that are in the foster care system.
And then what is the age of those kids typically?
So typically kids coming into the foster care system are going to be older kids, older than an infant, older than one. And really the purpose of the child welfare system is to maintain that child's safety that they couldn't otherwise maintain in their own home. And the purpose of the child welfare system is to reunify that child with that birth family. And so that family of origin. So the child welfare's goal is to try to fix that home so it's safe again for that child to return to.
So they're taking the child out of the home, hoping to stabilize the home, and then putting the child back into the home.
Yes.
So it takes a special person to be the one that is going to
caring for that child
for the child for a period of time.
Yeah.
How long it's usually for the foster
So, our laws state that a parent has anywhere from 9 months to a year to try to rehabilitate their home so it's safe again for that child to come back. Many times they're given longer than that because really the goal is for a child is to be able to return to that home if at all possible. Mm-hmm. So there's a case plan that parent is required to do, and there's services that DFACS, the Department of Family and Children Services, puts into place to try to make that home safe again. DFACS is also required during that whole time to look for relatives to see if there's relatives out there that could take this child. And if not a relative, then what they call kinship care. So a person that's like a family member, that's a friend, to take that child. If neither of those are options, then they'll look to a foster parent to care for the child.
So going back to the reproduction, so what happens that the couple decided to go through the in vitro or something,
so,
and then they get divorced. Then they have still eggs left in the freezer.
Sure. So if a couple decides to go through in vitro fertilization and they use embryos to create a child, and then there are leftover embryos or remaining embryos, those are usually frozen. Mm-hmm. And if the couple decide to separate, then what happens is the parties have to decide who has ownership, who has property rights of those embryos, and who's going to continue to pay the storage fee, because there's a storage fee for maintaining those embryos in cryopreservation.
But this is something that should be taken care of prior to all this, right?
Correct.
But they don't like to talk about it.
Well, most clinics will require you to fill out forms stating what you want to do. But I always tell family law attorneys that they need to make sure that in any settlement agreement or any order, they need to provide for those embryos, what's going to happen with those embryos, or any frozen egg or sperm or cord blood. So if there is any material that is being stored, they need to allot for it in any settlement agreement. Same thing for if in a will, if one party dies or both parties die, it needs to be spelled out in the will where those embryos or egg or sperm or cord blood will go to after death.
Right. But again, all this is easier before anything hectic happens.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? Yes.
But it's one of those things that people don't like to think about or talk about.
They don't. And so one thing that we do is we train family law attorneys and trust and estates attorneys to make sure that these are included in any wills or settlement agreements.
Right. So it's just part, if you just make it part of the system and questions you have to answer or things you have to sign, they'll just sign them, right?
Exactly.
But if you make it a thing after the fact, then it becomes leverage.
Right. It's always better to be proactive than reactive.
Right. So now, how did you get into this career? Like, how did this come about?
Sure. So I started out again as a child welfare attorney.
So right out of school, that's what you did?
Exactly. Yes. So I did it also as an undergrad. I was a social worker and I worked for the Department of Family and Children's Services as a case manager. And then I went back to law school and I represented children in foster care for about 17 years.
That must have been such a challenging emotionally and rewarding at the same time.
It was.
There must be tears, what, every day, every week?
Every week, I would say. It's hard. It is hard. But you also see inspiring stories as well. And that's what keeps you motivated day to day. I also went through my own infertility journey myself. And that's what sort of led me to shift to going into family building and assisted reproduction and adoption. Mm-hmm. So that was really what created the shift for me from child welfare to family building.
So now, do you mind talking about that? Or?
Sure.
So going through that shift, that was personal for you. And then where did you realize that you know what, maybe me being a lawyer can help this and how I can help other people? What challenges did you have?
Sure. So I went through in vitro fertilization myself and also went through J-Screen and genetic testing myself. Mm-hmm. After completing that journey, I have twins through our in vitro fertilization. It took me a couple years to kind of go through the process and decide that, you know what, I really want to work and help people get through this system and help them build their family versus what I was doing, which is really separating families and trying to get them back together again. So to be able to shift to building families was pretty meaningful.
So then when you made that shift for yourself, then you're dealing with people in different kind of states of mind.
Sure. Absolutely. And it's emotional to, you know, there is a grieving process of being able to grieve either not using your own gametes, your own egg or sperm or having to use a surrogate or adopting. There's a part of it where you're grieving your own loss of being able to either carry the pregnancy or use your own genetic material.
So people that are going through this, they feel like blame. There's a lot of blame and shame. With this that maybe a layperson doesn't realize?
Absolutely. It's hugely emotional to be able to go through this journey. And it's a roller coaster because there's a lot of ups and downs. And with that, it's very stressful. It's stressful in a marriage. It's stressful on a job. It's stressful with other family members. Mm-hmm. And it's very stressful.
Does the person going through it, is this something that they are reaching out to their kind of their parents, their siblings, or is it hard to find people that can relate to it?
It is hard to find people that relate to it. And also there's sometimes people feel some shame that, you know, their body's not working as they want it to, and there's embarrassment. And so unfortunately, there's a little bit of a stigma to it. And because of that, sometimes people don't reach out to family members and sisters and brothers. And it's also hard to be around people that already have children.
Right, because then you see your pregnant peer group is like, oh, everybody's having a kid except me. What's wrong with me?
Absolutely.
So that's a real feeling.
It is a real feeling. And, you know, I remember sometimes pulling into a parking lot and the only space was reserved for pregnant women. And I just wanted to park in that parking space.
And then, so when you went through this yourself and made this transition, how has that changed your life?
You know, I find that, you know, my career is hugely meaningful. I mean, I love being able to go to the hospital when someone either is giving birth through a surrogate or adopting, and being able to place that baby in the arms of the intended parents is huge.
Can you share a story of maybe of helping someone go through that and how they felt and what it meant to them and their family?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is sort of is a hybrid between what I'm doing now and what I used to do. I actually did an adoption recently for a foster parent that was adopting 6 children that she was fostering for 2 years.
Wow.
Yep. She adopted all six children. And the judge did the adoption.
At one time.
And
all
they're all siblings.
They were all siblings.
Wow. So for all of those children to be able to be together forever is great. And then right after we did the adoption, we actually did the wedding. So she got married and the judge did a wedding that same day. So being able to create that whole family legally.
So legally, the order had to be the adoption first, then the wedding?
Exactly. And so what was happening is they were getting married. The couple was getting married. And then after he had been in Georgia for 6 months, he can do a step-parent adoption. He didn't live in Georgia. And right now what the law says, and adoption law is actually changing in September. Right now our laws say that you have to live in Georgia 6 months before you can adopt in Georgia. And so because of that, he wasn't currently living in Georgia. So he had to live here for 6 months.
And so that's why the order was the adoption first.
Correct.
How interesting. Yes. It must be very rewarding work for you.
It's hugely rewarding. It, you know, there's no tears usually.
More happy tears.
Exactly.
So now, if somebody wants to learn more about your practice, what's the best way to find you?
Sure. So our website is gababylaw.com. We also have a surrogacy agency where we find surrogates for people, and that is southernsurrogacy.com.
And then Southern Surrogacy, that's not just Georgia, that's all over the South?
It's all over the South. So actually, Atlanta is the largest center for fertility resources in the Southeast.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, why is that? Is it through the Emory and the different universities?
Part of it is through Emory. We have more assisted reproduction technology fertility practices here in Georgia than anywhere else in the Southeast.
Wow. Good stuff, Junko. Right.
Yeah, thank you. And it's so interesting to learn about that. You know, I don't have so much knowledge about it, and it's very interesting.
How many people are there that are out there actively looking to kind of go this route?
To go the route of?
You know, having help with building their family. Is it like every day you're swamped with people?
Well, I would tell you that there are more people that are looking to build their family and are unable to. Then we do have egg donors, surrogates, and donors for sure. And birth parents looking to place their child for adoption. So the need is greater than the supply, I would say.
Wow.
Great. So my last guest.
The headliner.
Not the least, Robin Sangston. She's a VP and the Chief Compliance and Privacy Officer from Cox Communications. And I invited Robin because she has been recognized as a business leader in Atlanta. I mean, nationally and locally. But that's not the reason that I wanted it to come. And the reason I brought her today is to share your story, Robin, about your own journey in adoption. So
I think I was being set up.
it's an intervention.
But it's so fascinating because listening to Lynn and Karen, I realized I could have used their services at different points in my life. And unfortunately, because what Karen was doing wasn't even available when I was thinking about having my own family. Thankfully, it is now, but had it been available, I hope I would have availed myself of that. And then on what you're doing, I actually eventually did need an adoption attorney to help me when I did decide it was time to try to find my own birth parents. So thank you to both of you for what you do, because I'm a living example of how women in business that in your lines of work can definitely help somebody who's going through their own journey.
When did you start the journey of finding out?
When I was 50 years old, actually, because I was adopted back in 1962 in Washington, D.C. through Catholic Charities. And as you know, Washington, D.C. is a closed adoption state. So I had my own children in the 90s and decided that my birth parents were might be out there and I might be able to get some information for my own children who really didn't know 50% of their medical history, right? Mm-hmm. They knew a little bit about what their birth father brought to the table, but knew nothing about what I was bringing genetically to the table. And my parents who'd raised me at that point when I was 50, my my father had passed away, and my mom was at a point in her life where I knew that she would be okay if I set out to try to find my heritage, so to speak. I think maybe if I'd done that earlier, it would have been harder for her. And the nice part of the story is that when I did finally hire an adoption attorney in Washington, D.C. to go and file the papers in the court to try to get the judge to open the order Catholic Charities to unseal my file, my mother was totally on board with the journey and very, very excited. And in a little bit of the one door opening and the door closing, and I can't believe I'm going to cry, but sorry. After the court unsealed the record and Catholic Charities set about to let me know that both of my birth parents were still alive, I was able to tell my mother, and then she died a few weeks later.
Wow.
Now, when you found your birth parents, how was that? Like, what was that kind of that moment when you made the call? At some point, you got the information. That was one hurdle, right?
Yeah.
Then you got to make another decision.
Yeah, it really was. I think my reaction ended up being very different than I'd anticipated because, again, as I said, I really started this journey to find out information that would be useful to my three children so they might know what could be lurking there. And when Regina from Catholic Charities called me on the phone and said, well, I have good news. Both of your birth parents are still alive. I was doing the math in my head and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. They're both in their late 70s now and they're still alive. Isn't that like mostly what I really needed to know? And I can tell my kids that, you know, they don't come from some kind of genetic background where, you know, both of their grandparents, their maternal grandparents were dead in their 20s from, you know, cancer or something. Right. So, it wasn't like, oh, yay, my work is done here. But I'm like, that's really great news. And then I said to Regina, well, what happens next? And she says, well, we'll try to contact your birth mother first. And I said, well, you know, thinking, well, that's going to take forever because how are you going to find her? And sure enough, the Catholics keep very good records. Within literally a week or so, she had spoken to my birth mother on the phone, who at the time did not want to have contact with me, but was at least willing to give some information about her personal medical history. So I got a little bit of information there. And then I asked Regina, well, what happens next? And she says, now I'm going to try to contact your birth father. And I said, well, how are you going to find him? And she says, well, we know that actually your birth mother and father did marry eventually after they had me and were married for 11 years and then eventually divorced. And my birth father ended up out in California. So Regina sent him a letter, certified mail. And I'm thinking, well, that's a shot in the dark. I'm not expecting much there. And 2 days after getting the certified letter, he called into Regina and said, well, let me think about it. I'll call you back in 30 days. And I'm like, well, yeah, he's not going to do that, right? And sure enough, 30 days later, he called Regina and said, I'd be happy to have a conference call with her. So she facilitated a conference call. And that was kind of interesting. It was a little nerve-wracking as I'm sitting at my desk waiting for the phone to ring.
You were at work?
At work, closing the door and you know, turning off everything and just kind of sitting there waiting. And Regina called me on the phone and she was going to connect us together. And I'm like, well, wait, what do I call him? Birth dad? I mean, does he have a name? And she's like, yeah, his name's Ken. I'm like, oh, okay, Ken, great. So so I met Ken this was only about 4 months after I started the journey. And we had an amazing phone call. And in the whole like nature nurture thing, which really I'm like so 50-50 on now. It turned out that both of my parents who had adopted me and raised me were loving parents, but neither had gone to college and neither had been terribly able to support me when I put myself through college. And then I called them and said I was going to law school and I put myself through law school. And they were like, well, that's great. You know, it's wonderful, but they really weren't, that wasn't really something that they could help me a lot with. And within a few minutes of talking to Ken, I found out that he had gone to college literally 40 minutes away from where I went to college in Philly. He went to college in Princeton, New Jersey. I never knew that. I went to law school in Washington, D.C. He went to law school in Washington, D.C., 20 minutes away from my law school. So we had almost the identical academic pedigree without my knowing anything about that. So I do believe there is something to the, you know, nature nurture thing. And that was wonderful to learn about that. And since then, I actually have met my birth mother. A couple years ago after I went out and finally visited my birth dad in California and we really hit it off. he invited me and my husband to come to his college reunion in New Jersey. And I said, sure, that would be great. And then this is where the plot gets thicker. And it turns out that after they had me and put me up for adoption, they actually had two other daughters. So I have two 100% full-blooded mm-hmm. sisters who I've now met. They came in for the yeah. college reunion. And I have Danielle lives in London, and she married a Brit. And my other sister, Michelle, lives in Virginia, Northern Virginia. So I've now met them. And when I went to the reunion afterwards, we all drove down to Virginia, and my birth mom was there, and I got to meet her too. So that was really great.
So that is just like a whole other life appeared.
Mm-hmm. And a whole family that I never knew I had. Yeah. And we're leaving next weekend to go up to the reunion. And Ken and his current wife had another daughter. So I'm meeting my half-sister for the first time. So I have a half-sister.
But this all initially the impetus was, oh, I care about the medical. And that's important for my kids to understand the genetics and what kind of things might be ahead of them if I can help get them that information. Now cut to this information you have now, how much of it is that and how much is it now personal and emotional? And
good question. It actually was very useful. And the reason that Ken ultimately decided to talk to me was that in his 50s, he had been a marathon runner and very healthy. And suddenly he developed this heart condition that was very serious. And he ended up having to have surgery, and he is on medication, and he wanted me to be able to get his cardiology report. So I was able to go in and get a full test. And fortunately, I don't have the condition that he had, but now I'm able to give that to my children and they can get themselves checked out. Mm-hmm. So the medical part really was very, very valid. But you know, as you can tell, the journey ended up being a lot more emotional as well. And the fact that I have developed a rapport with, you know, this new family and taking it, you know, one day at a time, step by step. You don't immediately become a family, right?
Right.
Even if you're born into a family, you have to kind of earn it, right? So
now, and then your adopted parents, you said she died just within weeks of this. So it was like when that ended, then this whole other thing kind of bloomed.
Mm-hmm. It really was.
Did that help you go through that?
It was bittersweet. It definitely was. And I also have a sister I grew up with who was adopted through a totally different set of birth parents. And I've been telling her about my journey and she's interested, but she still has no interest in trying to find out anything about. Right. So it's very personal. I think you have to be at the right place. I wasn't at the right place in my life until I hit that magic 5-0, and you're kind of thinking, wow, I might be on the backside of my life.
Ahead of me.
I have three children, and don't I owe it to them to try to find this out? And they've now all met Ken, so that's kind of nice, too, that they have the opportunity to decide whether they want to have a relationship with their birth grandfather.
Well, the show is Health, Wealth, and Happiness, Junko. Mm-hmm. This is an amazing story, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. And so I'm just curious that have you ever asked Ken, like, why, you know, they put you in the adoption process?
I did. That's a whole nother story that we don't have time for. But in short, they both met in Washington, D.C. because they each were determined to work for the federal government,
CIA?
Actually, the CIA, yeah. And they were applying to be accepted into the program, and they developed a rapport, so to speak, mm-hmm. and ended up having me, or, you know, being pregnant with me. And at the time, you can probably understand why the CIA would not deploy operatives who had children. And mm-hmm. so they made the decision to put me up through Catholic Charities, which I'm ever grateful for. And I've always, people always say, well, were you ever upset that you were adopted, or did it make you feel in some way inferior or lesser in any way? And I said, no, I actually felt like it was a great gift.
Mm, yeah, that's molded your life, you know? And so how are you practicing and increasing your health, wealth, and happiness in your life? And what do you want to, you know, give to your children? Like, if you had known what you could have done, you know, before that you didn't know, but you can tell Amanda and your boys.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it goes back to the conversation that we were having here about it's information is power, right? Mm-hmm. And so you shouldn't put your head in the sand and shy away from getting information, right? Mm-hmm. It sometimes it can be a little scary maybe there's some risk associated with that, but I'm definitely an advocate in moving forward and taking advantage of the resources that are out there and you know, taking that plunge to find out more about yourself. And then once you have that information, that you can use that and make a good plan for going forward.
Yeah. Now, before talking to your birth parents, did you do those kind of saliva tests, the ancestor tests?
And I did not. I don't think they were really as well developed, and certainly not in the 90s when I was having my children, they weren't. And maybe, you know, this is now 5 years ago. I think that 23andMe was just starting, and I'm not sure there were, I mean, your offering was fairly new at the time. Maybe if someone had said you should try it, but I think those tests were all sort of in their nascency. And to me, and again, that is a good question though. I really wanted to know not just about what is there, you know, cancer lurking out there, or is there a heart condition lurking out there? I wanted to know some of that behavioral medical history too. Like, did this person end up becoming, you know, having some mental illness, or did these people go to college? Were they educated? So I wanted to know some of those social health factors as well, because I think that's an important part of the whole picture. It isn't just whether, you know, you're going to have cancer, you're going to have a heart attack. Is there a history of mental illness? Is there, you know, did these people pursue, you know, the world of the mind? And did they exercise? Did they like to travel? Again, I go back to that sort of nature, nurture. It's all sort of conjoined. And so I definitely wanted to get the information from the horse's mouth, so to speak, the people who actually had me. Probably a good idea to supplement with some of the other hard science, but I wanted sort of the soft science and the hard science.
So then once you got that information, how much of it is actionable, or did you change behaviors based on anything you learned?
Well, I definitely went and had that large scaled health check for my heart. And I passed all of that information on to my children too, so they can choose. They're all in their 20s now, they're adults, and they can make those decisions for themselves. So that was probably the biggest thing that I did immediately.
Right. Now, let's talk about it a little bit. You work in a corporate environment and you have three kids that are now older. What was it like to kind of live that life of balancing three children and corporate?
And single?
We can probably all. No, I wasn't. But I mean, probably every woman around the table that has stories about, you know, it's sort of a fallacy to call it balancing, right? You're juggling at best, and trying to make sure that the balls aren't falling off the table onto the floor and catching them before they hit.
The important ones.
Yeah. You know, I always say that you can, as a woman in business who chooses to have children, you really can have it all, but you can't have it all at the same time. So you're sequencing your life. There's always some part of your life that's maybe not doing quite as well as another part. And as long as you feel that your children are relatively healthy and safe and your job is chugging along, that's pretty much all you can ask for at any given time. And then you get to be a little older like I am now, where I'm an empty nester, and you can start reevaluating what aspects of your life may have fallen by the wayside. Like, have you lost contact with old friends, or are you not working out as much as you like, or are you not traveling as much as you want? And you can add those things back into the equation. And it's a good time to do a self-assessment and say, you know, what can I change right now? What are the things that I loved earlier that are missing, and how can I bring that back into my life? So it's a constant journey like that, right? Everyone's nodding their head.
So
around
it's kind of, it's just prioritizing based on what stage you are.
Absolutely.
Kind of readjusting, not having kind of a master plan necessarily.
And not beating yourself up. I think women are so hard on themselves. We've all grown up with this false sense of we have to be perfect. And we beat ourselves up if we're, you know, comparing ourselves to the woman down the street who may or may not work or may or may not have children, but has the perfect house and the perfect hair and all of that. And like, why can't I be like that? And you don't know what that woman is dealing with, some of her own challenges too. And I'm sure if you sat down and had a cup of coffee with her, each one of you would very quickly figure that we're both doing really well in most respects, but there's some things that aren't, and we can be more empathetic with ourselves, I think, about that.
Love yourself is very important.
Mm-hmm. I think we all agree on that.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. And it's a great stories that you shared with
everyone.
Thank you, Junko.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee.
All right. Well, thank you, Junko, for making this happen.
Thank you.
This is episode number 2 for Junko's Health, Wealth, and Happiness Hour. You having a good time?
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for putting this all together. Thank you to Fujiyama Wealth Management that sponsors the show. This is Lee Cantor for Junko Horvath. We will see you all next time on Junko's Health, Wealth, and Happiness Hour.
Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Registered representative, securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member, FINRA/SIPC. Investment advisor representative, Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Fujiyama Wealth Management and Cambridge are not affiliated.